My name is Dan Spencer, and delighted to see all of you here tonight. This is the first session of what I hope will be a five-part series on being gay and Christian in the church today, and looking at some of the different angles on that. Tonight I've entitled the talk, Reflections from the Journey. Just some points about I want to talk about in terms of what it is like to be both gay and Christian, and how a person comes to that realization and tries to integrate that. So that's what I hope to talk about tonight. I'd like to open with just a brief word of prayer, so if you would join me in that. Most gracious and liberating God, we're aware that we live in a world too often characterized by hurt and brokenness and alienation. Alienation from you and alienation from each other. And yet in the midst of that world, you call us to be a loving, reconciling presence. We ask that you bless us tonight with a spirit of openness and reconciliation to hear from each other on a subject that has been hurtful to many. In the name of the one who came to reconcile us to you, Jesus Christ, we pray. Amen. One of the things that I did on the train ride out here was to read over the last 6 months' work of the Lutheran. I don't know how many of you read the Lutheran. I'm not Lutheran myself, so I don't get it directly, but I have been hearing about the ongoing debate about the three gay seminarians and the whole debate over whether they should be ordained or not. So I read over that, thinking I ought to be at least familiar with what was happening within the Lutheran Church, since most of you are probably Lutheran, although not all of you. And it brought back to me again just what a very difficult topic this is, the whole topic of homosexuality and the church. What was especially apparent was the passion in the letters to the editor following each of the articles. A passion on both sides. People who are very, very fearful that if we allow gay people into the church, although we've been here for years, as we'll see, but if we allow us to acknowledge ourselves within the church, that means that we are giving in to the world and giving up the gospel. And people on the other side who are equally passionate in their conviction that unless the church opens up and is inclusive to all people, including lesbians and gay men, we've also lost the gospel. So I know that there are a lot of very strong and high feelings on all sides of this issue, and I want to be sensitive to that tonight. I know that for many of us, probably all of us, at one point or another, to even imagine the words gay and Christian in the same phrase, referring to the same person, would have sounded scandalous to our ears, and for many of us it may still do so. Certainly within my theological upbringing within the Catholic Church, it wasn't even thought of that those two might be or together in one person, with somebody being both gay and Christian. And so I know that can really ring difficult in our ears. What I would like this to be tonight in particular, and then throughout the rest of the week though, is to be a conversation about what it feels like to have that experience, to begin to understand that one's own identity is both gay and Christian, and how, in my case, I've tried to resolve that and integrate that, and also bring in the insights of other gay Christians. But I do very much want to encourage this to be a conversation, to hear from all sides, to hear the points that are hard, the points that are fun, the points that are filled with joy, the points that are filled with pain, questions, so forth. So please feel free, regardless of where you're coming from, to enter into that conversation. And I hope that all of us will respect everybody's viewpoint on that. I'd like to begin tonight with a story, and then use excerpts of that story and stories of other gay people to make some points before we open up for discussion. And the choice of beginning with a story is intentional. I believe that oftentimes truth, especially the most difficult and yet most profound truths, are best conveyed through story. And I think the best example of that we have is the Bible, which is the story of God's people and God's people in relationship to God. Jesus, time and again, chose story as the means of illustrating truth to people. And story helps generate other symbols. So I'd like to start with that. The other reason is, I think on an issue that's as divisive as homosexuality has been and continues to be, it's very important that we begin our conversation by rooting it in the lives of real people. Otherwise, the debate can very quickly become abstract, and we forget that we're talking about real people for whom this issue is very important. So I have a short story here that's called The Boy. I want to tell a story. It's a story about a boy who grew up in a large family with lots of sisters and a brother in a big house where he learned to love and to be loved. The boy loved many things. He loved the nearby mountains with the boulders to climb on and the rushing little streams. And he loved little children. Even as a child, he loved little children and dreamed of the day when he would have his own family with lots of children like his own family. The boy was often sick and spent many hours and nights on a respirator and getting weekly shots. But he didn't mind too much because it meant he could read and read, which he loved. And sometimes it meant more time in the mountains so that his legs and lungs could grow strong. But one day it did make him sad because his sickness meant he had to go away from his family to go to school in another state. So the boy went and he learned to love new things. Early morning walks on the prairie, thunderstorms in the fall and spring, snow in the winter, and of course children. The boy was happy because there were many children at the school and he soon became the babysitter for the campus. He began to care for children in many of the faculty families, and he was happy for a while. But all was not well, for he was learning that while people talked about loving other people, they only meant some other people. It seemed it was all right for boys to have girlfriends, and girls to have boyfriends, and even girls had girlfriends, but boys were never to have boyfriends. It puzzled him that most of his friends were interested only in girls, and he was not. But it didn't bother him too much. He got a girlfriend, and he figured that he too would change to be like the other boys. Soon it was time to go to college, and the boy knew that he could now study what he had always loved, the mountains, the prairie, the rivers. So he went to a college where he could study geology. There he soon became friends with another boy who was also studying geology, and they began to do many things together, even spending their summers together working in the mountains. They were both Christians. They taught Sunday school class together, and they spent many hours talking and talking. Gradually, the boy realized he was in love with his friend, which frightened him badly. And he prayed and prayed that God would change him soon, so that he could have girlfriends like the other boys. He didn't know what he had done to be the way he was, but he knew it must have been very bad. Then one day, his friend came to him with exciting news. His friend was in love with a girl who was a friend to both of them. Now the boy was very confused and sad, and he went to the woods that he loved so and cried. Once more, he tried to talk to God, but it didn't seem that God was listening. The boy just couldn't understand. He knew that if one believed, one was saved. And he had heard that grace was a gift given unconditionally without works. But he also knew that boys who loved boys were never saved, but evil. He knew that who he was so terrible that he could never tell anyone. And he began to walk in front of cars on the highway by the woods, hoping that they would take him away from his pain. The boy went to the school counselor, who was also a friend from his church. But he was so ashamed, he made up another story. That helped for a while, but he still loved his friend, who now spent all his time with his new girlfriend. They didn't teach Sunday school together anymore or talk for hours. Finally, the boy decided he needed to leave. And so he went to Latin America, where he again lived close to the land he loved so, with simple, friendly people, and he was happy. The hurt was less now, and while he still prayed to be changed, He began to feel that maybe he was just meant to never love, never have anyone to love. He didn't understand why, and he was sad that he would never have the family he had always wanted. And so the years passed. Sometimes it hurt very much, and sometimes not so much. His friend married the girl, and the boy was the best man. Then they moved away, and the boy went again away to the mountains to live. Once more it was hurting too much, and so he decided that he must find a way to change, for he could not go on living with the pain. After 3 months, he got enough courage up to go and visit the village pastor, someone he admired very much. He summoned up his courage, looked at the pastor, and said, "What I want to know is if you believe in healing for homosexuals." There, now he had said it. Someone knew. Even if he changed now, someone would always know. He had never felt so naked, so vulnerable, so exposed, or so honest. Yes, he found that he felt vulnerable, but to his surprise, he felt a huge weight lifted from him. Finally, the ball was in the other court. If the pastor said no, or got angry, or whatever, the boy now felt that he could die in peace. At least the horrible truth was no longer stewing bottled up inside him. And then the boy found that God's grace often comes in unsuspected packages. The pastor looked at him without even batting an eye and calmly said, "That depends on whether there's a brokenness." Well, the boy was stunned. Could revelation, the gospel, the good news, really come through 8 simple words? Could 23 years of perspective be stood on end so simply, so calmly? They were. The boy finally received and experienced the grace he had heard about for so long. He understood now the metanoia, the turnaround. Suddenly, those oft-repeated words became real to him, central to his being. "Nothing can separate me from the love of God." At that moment, nothing could. The years have passed. The boy has learned more about receiving grace, more about being a receptacle of God's grace to others. The boy still loves other boys, and sometimes this hurts him because there are many who don't believe that God's grace is meant for boys who love boys. Sometimes the boy feels that way too. But when the boy feels like that, when he feels very sad and unable to talk to even those who love him best, he remembers the story, his story. And he remembers the stories of others too, of how nothing separated them from the love of God. And sometimes he's still sad, but hopeful too. And he hopes that his story might help other people, like their stories have helped him. As you probably all realize, the story is my own story. In fact, the village pastor was the pastor of Holden Village many years ago. So Holden has been a very special and important place to me. It was a place of healing, a place of learning to grow, a place of integrating my faith and my sexuality. Part of why I start with a story and my own story is because I think it's very important to change the parameters of the discussion from us versus them to us. Lesbian, gay issues, the issue of homosexuality, is one that touches all of us, regardless of what our sexuality is. All of us have met someone who is homosexual. In the vast majority of the cases, we haven't known that, because most of us who are gay or lesbian have been forced to hide who we are. And yet all of us have friends, or family members, or spouses, children, or ourselves who are very deeply touched by this issue. And so it's important that we get past talking about those people over there and talking about us as a human family and how this issue has divided and hurt us for many years. What I'd like to do at this point is just talk a little bit about what it means to be gay. And then I'd like to talk a little bit about what it means to be gay and Christian. I've had a lot of conversations over the years, and it's been fun. It really has been fun to see what kinds of questions emerge from that. But one of them that's always interesting to me, and it's a very sincere question, people come up to me and say, "Dan, I've never met a gay person." And in their own mind, they never have. They know what they're really saying is they've never met anybody who they knew was gay. But all of us have met someone who's gay. But the question they're asking is, "I don't know what gay people are like. What are gay people like?" And so I'm often tempted to respond by saying, "Well, we like to ski, we like to ride bikes, we like to go shopping, sometimes we eat too much." And the point is not to be flip, but the point is that in almost all areas of our life, we're just like everybody else. We hurt, we love, we laugh, we have joy, we have pain, just like all of us do. We struggle with what it means to be human in all of its various manifestations. And yet, there is one thing that characterizes our lives as gay people that's very different than for most other people. And that is that we have been taught, from as early as we can remember, to be ashamed of who we are and to hide that from other people. And so most of us who are gay spend many, many years constructing a false appearance about who we are to protect our identities, to protect the part of us that matters most to us from other people. That whole fear of being discovered and having to pay the cost of being gay in a society that does not accept gay people by and large. Another question that people ask me is, "I accept you for who you are, Dan, but I just don't understand why anybody would choose to be that way." That's a good question. We all operate out of our own experience, and what seems normal to us is usually what our own experience is. And if you're not homosexual, probably seems pretty bizarre. But the point is, there is a question of choice involved, but the choice is not whether one is going to be homosexual or not homosexual. The choice is whether one is going to acknowledge who we are as sexual people or continue to hide that. Everyone I've ever talked to who is gay or lesbian has had an experience similar to mine, and that is that we have not chosen to be homosexual. It's something that we've discovered about who we are. It's something that as we grow up, starting oftentimes from our very earliest memories of somehow feeling we were different than other people, but at age 4 or 5, you don't know what that means, to then that intense period of puberty, which all of us probably remember very, very well and never want to repeat, but those very intense sexual feelings and just being mortified to realize they weren't going the right way, that all my male friends were going towards girls and mine weren't, and not knowing what in the world to do with that, to finally having to come to the point in the years of struggle of hiding, of trying to change, of getting girlfriends, all the kinds of things that many of us have experienced, those of us who are gay, realizing it just isn't working. And so the choice then becomes not whether I'm going to be heterosexual or going to be homosexual, but I am homosexual, and what am I going to choose to do about it? A choice of acknowledgement or a choice of whether we continue to hide and live a life of deceit. People oftentimes ask, well, not even people, all of us wonder, what is the difference between being gay or straight? What does it mean to be homosexual? What does it mean to be heterosexual? And there are a lot of different clinical sounding definitions, but the one that I think is most appropriate is that the difference between being gay and straight is in the different ways we choose to love and be in relationship in our most intimate form with other people. Basically, heterosexual people, by and large, are more comfortable in being in intimate relationship and loving people of the opposite gender. And homosexual people are more comfortable experiencing love and relationship with other people of their own gender. For lesbians, that means being in relationship with other women who are lesbian. And for gay men, that means being in relationship and loving, experiencing intimacy with other men. if you'll notice, this definition has no values attached to it. It doesn't say that heterosexual love is superior or inferior to homosexual love. It means it's different. We can then choose to put value on those relationships, and we can decide that heterosexual love is superior or that lesbian love is superior. But we need to be realized that we're choosing to do that. It's not inherent in the relationships themselves. The other thing I want to mention that for me, part of the whole experience of coming to grips with being both gay and Christian has involved a lot of irony and a lot of humor, as well as a lot of pain. But in the gay community, we deal with our own oppression a lot through humor. It's the only way that we find of surviving sometimes. And irony. And irony can both be funny, but it can also be very painful. For me, one of the very ironic things about discrimination against lesbians and gay men, particularly in the church, is that in contrast to many different forms of discrimination that are based on physical characteristics, our skin color, what gender we are, how old we are, whether we have four functioning limbs, whatever, that's not the case with lesbians and gay men. Our discrimination is based on who we choose to love. It's based on who we choose to be in relationship with in all its various aspects. And ironically, I've always learned that Christianity is a religion whose core element, if you were going to ask how to sum up what Christianity is, it's a religion based on love. And yet that's the point where we get excluded. That's the point where we oftentimes are oppressed, is because of how our love takes shape. It's a point worth pondering. Many Christians throughout the ages have suffered greatly because of the radical demands of Jesus' love. Jesus demands that we love and love radically. And yet I think that gay people know, as perhaps few of us can, what it means to suffer for the sake of love and those we choose to love. The theme while we're up here this summer is something afoot in the universe. There's something afoot in the universe. For better or for worse, gay people are afoot in the universe like never before. And we are finding ways to express who we are in different contexts like never before. And not only gay people, lots of people who have traditionally been excluded, people of color, women, people with physical disabilities, all are finding ways to express and no longer remain silent in who we are. One of the things that we do, that we find very important to do about that, is to recover a sense of history of who we are. We begin to realize that history, as it's been taught to us, excludes who we are. And for the women in the audience, I think that's probably a very obvious point. You learn that even though you make up 51% of the world's population, you might at the most make up 2% of the world's historically important figures. Why is that? Well, basically, history tends to get written by the winners. And men have been in a dominant position and have written history, and we consider ourselves more important. So we write history from that viewpoint. Similarly, if you look back through the last thousands of years, you aren't going to find much reference to gay people. Not because we weren't there. Somehow it wasn't considered important to mention us.
Or at least that aspect of their life was excluded.
At least that aspect of their life, which may have been very important to them, was not included, right? And yet, what does that do to someone who has been trying to get in touch with their experience? We all take great pride in our histories, the history of this country and the histories that we've accomplished. The Bible is the history of God's relation to God's people, and that forms our values. And yet, we as gay and lesbian people find that we are people with a history that's hidden. And so we begin to try and reconstruct it. We find that people that we've heard a lot about have things in common with us, but we didn't know about it. People like Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci were homosexual. Authors like Willa Cather and Gertrude Stein were lesbian. We've learned a lot about these people, but for some reason we were never told that part about them, even though that's the part that expressed their deepest form of intimacy. And so we began the very painful and liberating and exciting process of rediscovering who we are. And for gay and lesbian people, as for all oppressed people, it comes at a price. We learn many of the very painful and ugly things about our history, as well as the wonderful things. One of the first things that I learned came out of the Bible. I learned that homosexuality was an issue you just didn't talk about. But when I did hear about it, it was exclusively negative. And I remember vividly the first time I heard Leviticus 20 quoted as a young boy, and beginning to wonder what I was experiencing. Imagine yourself being a young boy and hearing this. If a man lies with a man as with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall be put to death. This was a terrifying thing to hear as a boy going through puberty and knowing that these intense feelings I was going through were oriented towards men and not towards women. And the only frame of reference I had was this verse from Leviticus. Other things about our history. We learn where some of the roots of the nicknames that are thrown against us come from. You're probably all familiar with the term faggot. Oftentimes gay men are labeled faggots or fags. But how many of us know where that comes from? I see some hands, which is encouraging, because we're all learning about our history. The term, you know the quote official definition of faggot, if you read it in Webster's Dictionary, you'll know that it means a bundle of sticks that were used to light fires. Well, it comes from a period in the Middle Ages when being homosexual was a crime punishable by death. And it was a time when there was a great persecution against witches, against women who were thought differently than the church, and many, many women and witches were being burned at the stake. And yet, oftentimes, to light those fires, they rounded up homosexual men to be the ones who lit the fires to burn the witches at the stake. And since that was what you usually used to start to burn people at the stake were faggots, bundles of wood, this simply became a term that was applied to homosexual men to round them up and light the fires to burn witches. It's a terrifying, horrible term. And I wonder how many of us, when we call someone a faggot or listen to a fag joke, have any idea what kind of history is conjured up by that term, and yet that's part of our history. Another part of our history, if you had any contact with the gay and lesbian community, particularly around Gay Pride Week, which just took place a couple weeks ago, it's the last week of June every year, you'll know that one of the symbols of gay liberation is the pink triangle. You'll see gay men and lesbians wearing buttons with a pink triangle, or you'll see other references to the pink triangle. How many of you are familiar with where the pink triangle comes from? Getting some hands, that's wonderful. It comes from another part of our history. During the time of Nazi Germany, people are aware of what happened to the Jews under Hitler. Some of us are aware of what happened to the Gypsies under Hitler. But very few of us, thankfully more and more, are aware of what happened to homosexual people in the time of Hitler. We are one of the largest groups of people that were systematically rounded up, along with Jews and Gypsies and others, radicals, socialists, communists, who were rounded up systematically and put to death in the concentration camps. And like the Jews, who were forced in the concentration camps to wear a yellow Star of David on their uniform to show their crime of being Jew, homosexuals were required to wear a pink triangle on their uniform to show their crime of being homosexual. It's estimated somewhere between 200,000 and 300,000 homosexuals were put to death in the concentration camps for their crime of being homosexual. And yet, one of the very sad things about the liberation of the concentration camps is that all sectors of the camps were liberated except for homosexual men, homosexual people. Because ironically, it was a crime in all of the countries of the so-called liberating armies to be homosexual. In the Soviet Union, in the United States, in France, and Great Britain. All of those societies had laws against being homosexual. And I've seen film documentary of this, that when the armies came in to liberate the concentration camps, they separated the prisoners who were wearing the pink triangle apart from the others and let the others go free and re-imprisoned the homosexuals because they were legitimate criminals in the eyes of what we hear about as the liberating armies. That's part of our history, and it's a very painful part to reclaim. And yet we as gay and lesbian people reclaim the painful parts in order to be able to move on to the life-giving parts. And so the symbol of the pink triangle for us has become much like the Star of David for the Jewish people, a sign of never again. We will never again be silent and passive to allow ourselves to be rounded up and put to death by people who define us as criminals. To sum up, I realize I'm painting a pretty bleak picture of what it can mean to be gay, and yet it's important that we realize that growing up gay, I would say that the dominant emotion that's experienced by most of us, and thankfully this is changing, but for most of us, the dominant experience has been one of fear. It has been the fear of being different, the fear of being misunderstood, the fear of being rejected, the fear of being imprisoned, being consigned to hell, whatever. There's always been that fear of someone finding out who we are and us having to pay the consequences of that. And so it's very interesting for me when I talk with other adult friends and who reminisce about their childhood and talk about, wouldn't it be great if we could live our childhood again? An awful lot of us who are gay would never want to live that again, because that was such a painful period of our lives. And we're glad to have gotten through it and be where we are today. Let me talk now, though, a little bit about what it means to be both gay and Christian. Because I found myself with a real paradox as I was growing up. I'd always considered myself Christian. I was raised in a Catholic family, and that was a very important part of who I was. And then I discovered myself to also be gay, and all the messages I'd ever received meant that I couldn't be both. And so I had to start working with, what does it mean? How am I going to be forced to choose? Whatever. And yet, I've come to believe that to be openly gay and to be openly Christian means to understand at a deep level the difference between cheap grace and costly grace. It means being able to say, here is my life, Lord, take me. And lead me where you will. Why do I say this? To be openly gay and to be openly Christian means that one will have had to count the cost to get to that point. Both of those are going to have to be important enough to you to reach that point. It means understanding grace as the experience of no longer being ruled by fear, but by faith and trust in God. I want to read just an excerpt from a statement from the Lesbian and Gay Caucus at Union Theological Seminary in New York, where I attended seminary about 5 years ago, as we were trying to struggle with the issue of what it meant to be lesbians and gay men in the context of seminary, and if the discrimination we were facing. So we put down a faith statement about what our faith meant to us. He wrote, "The power of letting God love us is instrumental in letting us live our lives openly as lesbians and gay men, in spite of possible denominational rejection and restriction on our vocational goals. For many lesbians and gay men, the first experience of grace in their lives is the moment of recognition that they are loved by God and can choose to live openly in the way God has created them to be. For many of us, the sense of celebration, love, and community we share being out has far surpassed the many fears we held while being in the closet. The main pain we feel is loneliness and a sense of loss. Loss due to the absence of those who are not out of the closet, and therefore of whose communion we are denied. While the structures that oppress lesbians and gay men are very real, the fear that prevents us from confronting them is part of the principalities and powers that Christians believe Christ defeated on the cross. These powers operate through fear to keep us in our closets and protect straight privilege. Yet as we claim as our authority the love of God rather than the fear of the world, we begin to understand what it means to live by faith." For me, learning to really understand what it meant to be Christian and means to be Christian meant learning to trust fully in God and my relationship with Christ and not the fear that I had grown up with around the experience of being gay. I had learned so deeply this feeling of fear that I had taken on an image of myself that I could only be a source of hurt and disappointment for those I loved. And so the fear, we use the term in the gay community of being in the closet. When we're not honest about who we are, we hide that from other people, we talk about being in the closet. When we talk about coming out of the closet, it means acknowledging first to ourselves and then to other people that we are lesbian or gay. And that's a lifelong process for many of us. And I had so strongly taken upon me or internalized the attitudes of the society towards homosexual people that I saw myself exclusively in negative terms, and I saw myself as only being a source of hurt and disappointment to my family. This was particularly hard for me because I come from a very loving and warm family. And in fact, in conversations with them lately, this has been the most hurtful thing for them. For when they've said to me, how could you have ever thought that you were going to hurt us? And I know particularly for my parents, the period that I went through life where I seriously contemplated suicide is so hurtful to them because they can't even imagine me ever feeling that alienated from them to contemplate that. And yet I had learned so much that the only thing that I could see myself as was a negative thing, a source of hurt and disappointment, that I seriously contemplated killing myself rather than admitting to them that I wasn't who they thought I was. I eventually did talk to my folks, and in fact I wrote them a long letter explaining what I was going through. Here's just a short excerpt from the letter. But I think it demonstrates some of the struggle to acknowledge first to oneself and then to people that we love who we are. I wrote to them, in the 2 years since I decided to be open with you about being gay, I was always sure that I would not do it through a letter. I wanted to talk with you both together, and yet here I am writing to you about it. Most of the reason for this has been my very real fear that you would experience my being honest with you only as bad news. And that was the last thing I wanted to do, to be a further cause of hurt and disappointment in your lives. But if there is one thing that I am repeatedly learning in my slow and at times painful journey of faith, it is that Christ asks us that we always be honest, that we live honestly. To contemplate a life of ministry while having part of me be hidden in fear and deceit is too much of a contradiction for me to consider it any longer. I have to trust in God and Christ that grace will see me through the difficult times ahead that will certainly follow from deciding to be open and honest about who I am. Another one of the little ironies for me in my journey of faith was that perhaps my fullest experience of grace came when I realized that answering what I had understood to be a very strong call from God to ministry would mean that I would be rejected by the church. The church would refuse to ordain me, and I would have to find other means to answer that call. So I had to decide between the church and answering a call of God in order to live out my life of faith. And yet what I've learned and continue to learn through this journey is that God's grace doesn't always come easily, but it's there and it's sufficient if I'm willing to take the first step and trust. And I have come to understand grace as a call to be honest, first with ourselves and with our neighbor and with God, and trust in God to provide us the strength and grace to see it through. I remember the first time I was at Holden, and I was very much in the closet, about 9 years ago, and we read books by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And one of the things that Dietrich Bonhoeffer stressed over and over was the difference between cheap grace and costly grace, and how we as Christians need to count the cost of our faith. I really didn't understand what that meant at the time. But since that time, at least for me, I've understood at a fairly deep level what that means. Because as a gay Christian, you really have to count the cost before coming out of the closet. Your faith has to mean enough to you to be willing to put up with the kind of pain and rejection that we'll face. And it's not only counting the cost as far as our faith, it's also counting the cost as far as our gay identity. Because we not only face rejection from the church, we oftentimes face rejection from many sectors of the gay community who have been so hurt by the church that they don't want to have anything to do with it. And the last thing they want to deal with is a Christian, is a gay person who also thinks he's Christian. They've gotten over that long ago and don't want anything to do with it. And so we oftentimes find ourselves walking this tightrope, trying to justify to the church why we can still be Christian, and trying to justify to our gay brothers and sisters why we can still be gay and proud of it, and not having a lot of guidelines on that walk. And yet I maintain that when you can publicly affirm that you're openly gay and openly Christian, that's what you know what it means to put your faith solely in Christ. That's when grace becomes real to you. One of the most helpful books for me in this is a book that's here both in the library and the bookstore. It's a little book called Embracing the Exile, Healing Journeys of Gay Christians. And I want to just read a little excerpt of that. The fellow who writes it, John Fortunato, maintains that coming out in the church means that you'll probably be in exile within your own community. And so he writes here, to be gay and Christian, integrating both into the wholeness we deep down know ourselves to be, to embrace them both as gifts of God, and to live our lives authentically, rejoicing in those gifts as part of the uniqueness that makes us who we are, is to place ourselves on the outskirts of the community we most care about. It's beyond the realm of choice. Exile is simply where we find ourselves to be when we are who we are. It's most often a hard place to be. Banished. We come bearing gifts that aren't welcome. We come with love to give that's rejected. Outcasts, despised and rejected of men and women, driven to the desert, or at least to that rather desolate ribbon of land that keeps the desert at bay from the arable land that most people inhabit. Yet God's charge is to all of us to love them anyway. Loving anyway. Sharing anyway, giving gifts even when no one wants them, embracing the exile. Loving in the face of utter rejection means following in some of the most painful footsteps of Jesus Christ. But I'm convinced that peace is to be found in accepting the calling. Not peace in the everyday sense of tranquility, but the kind of peace that emerges from believing in our wholeness and the rightfulness in our place in the creation. Loving in the face of persecution may not always yield happiness, but it seems to be the only response that allows us to make any sense at all of our lives. It's interesting to me that when I first began to work with this, it was about 4 or 5 years ago, and at that point, this was pretty much where I ended the talk. And I realized it's a fairly heavy place to end. And yet for me, that's where I was. I was in a place where I had just recently come out to my family, recently come out to Holden Village. Many friends that I'd had for many years, I didn't know what the verdict was going to be, whether they were going to continue to be friends. And so for me, it was a very, very deeply spiritual time, but very troubling time. And so the pain was very real, and it's still very real. It's a very real part of my life. And yet, the good news is that it has been overshadowed by the tremendous amount of joy and affirmation of life that has also been a gift to me in the 5 years since. I realized that coming out for me has been much like the story of Lazarus coming out of the tomb. I came out as a different person, and I came out of the tomb or the closet to a family who didn't know the new me because they were used to the old me and were a little bit afraid about the new me. I didn't fit in with the rules of the game, but we've learned to love and work and grow and walk together, and I've experienced life to be more rich and deep and joy-filled than I ever imagined it could be. And so people oftentimes ask me, If you had it all over to do again, would you come out of the closet? Or do you ever regret being out of the closet? And never, not one day since, have I ever regretted it. It has been, for me, the most real way of experiencing the love of Christ and love of God and integrating who I know myself to be now. And it has allowed me friendships and intimacy with other people, both gay and non-gay, that I never imagined possible before. And it has made real for me the whole claim of Christ that if we're going to follow him, we need to pick up our cross and follow him, to count the cost, to know that it'll be painful, but to also know that God's grace is sufficient, that there are many joy-filled steps along the way, and to witness with the early church that despite the persecution, despite the pain, there's no turning back, because we've learned something about what creation is all about, that once you've learned it, there's no taking it away from you. And so, oh, I hadn't quite expected to get quite into this kind of a testimony. I'll end here. but what I want to say is that, to reaffirm, this is an opening part of a conversation. Just to briefly mention some of the other talks that are set aside this week. I've set aside a couple talks to look at the Bible, because that's important for all of us, gay and non-gay alike, to look at the traditional teachings of the Bible, to look at why the Bible is important to gay and lesbian Christians. I also want to talk a little bit more about the kind of discrimination that we face as lesbians and gay men in society and in the church, the kind of discrimination that we've called homophobia, and how that fear of gay people affects all of us. And I want to talk a little bit about the contributions that I see lesbians and gay men making to the vast contributions that all of us make to the church and our spirituality and who we see ourselves as church. But those will come later. Tonight is a chance to, for those of you who have never met a gay person, now you've got one right in front of you, a real live homosexual. But to have a chance to talk about the experience of being lesbian gay, and I know there are other people here who are gay themselves or have very close family members or friends who are lesbian gay, and I welcome your participation in all the conversations. So with that, I'll open it up for, I guess we've got another 10 or 15 minutes for comments or conversation.
I've got one.
Yeah.
Kind of along the lines of the terminology you're talking about. Two things. One, why do you say gay and straight, and why do you say gay men and lesbian?
Good questions. I'll repeat it for the tape. The question is, why do we use the terms gay and straight, and why do we use the terms gay men and lesbians to distinguish them? There are a lot of different reasons, and I don't even know what all the official ones are, but one of them is the term homosexual is one that most gay men and lesbians don't choose to apply to ourselves for a number of reasons. It was developed in the context where it was used to describe a pathology or an illness. Someone was described as homosexual because they were deviant or sick. And it's a very clinical term that applies to a very small aspect of who we are. It's not a term that we choose to identify ourselves with. The term gay has very ancient roots, going back at least 400 or 500 years, and no one is sure exactly where it comes from. It's traceable in several different languages, but it became most clearly identified in about the 1920s, primarily first in Europe and then in the United States, as a very small minority of gay people began to identify themselves as a community and chose that term to describe themselves. And so much in the same way that black people insist on being called black rather than Negroes, gay people have chosen that as a term of self-affirmation. It tends to mean people who have come to grips with being homosexual in terms of their sexual orientation and are increasingly comfortable about it. It oftentimes has been used to describe the gay male community more than the gay female community, and so many women who are gay or homosexual have chosen the term lesbian to identify themselves, which is an even older term than the term gay. It comes from the island of Lesbos in Greece, and a kind of an ancient women's oriented community there. And so there are many women who are comfortable describing themselves as gay and other who would rather describe themselves as lesbian, much as there are many women who do not feel included in the term mankind, would rather include womankind or humankind. And so they, both of them are terms that, that homosexual people have chosen to apply to themselves as a term of affirmation, rather than the term homosexual, which is kind of clinical and has a negative history.
About straight.
Oh, straight. I'm sorry. The term straight, and that's not even a very good term. Mm-hmm. I think increasingly, it also comes, I think, out of much of the early homosexual community where we were saw ourselves as deviant. We're deviating from the straight and narrow path. We're deviating from people in society who were straight, who played by the rules, and so straight began to be identified with heterosexual, and gay or deviant or pervert, whatever, begin to identify with homosexual. And so it's simply a term that has gotten used. I have a number of non-gay friends who despise it and insist on being called other things. A good friend of mine, Ray McKeever, has a song about it. He says, he will go up to me and put his arm around me and say, and I'll say, I'm gay, and Ray will say, and I'm glad. And that's we talk about the gays and the glads. We need to find another term and that is affirming of heterosexuals that isn't heterosexual. And we're not at the point yet because non-gay is not a good term either. Nobody wants to be termed by negating someone else's identity. But it simply has been the term that's been most used up to this point. Gay and straight have been the two sides of the coin. We had, I don't know whether I should bring this up or not, but again, humor has been very important to us in the gay community to affirm who we are. And I hope no one will be offended by this, but one of my favorite terms has been the gays and the grims. So oftentimes when this issue has been approached in the church, it's approached with such seriousness and such a sense of being grim that we thought, heck, if they're going to call us gay, we'll call them grim.
From what you have said now, this hour, it makes me realize that I think I know someone that is gay and is very in the closet. And I'm just wondering if he comes out of the closet, if he would feel better about himself and be, because he's a very uptight person. And if there's something that, some kind of loving concern saying, are you gay? And having them express it. If that would be helpful, or if it's better not to say.
My own opinion is that the process of coming out is such an important one to each person that they have to be the ones who decide mm-hmm. At what point they're going to make themselves known. But there are a lot of things the rest of us can do to help ease that way. We can educate ourselves about the subject. We can be affirming of gays and lesbians in our conversation. There are a lot of clues and signals that we can give to people. And believe me, anybody who is closeted will pick up on them. And we are very, very good at knowing, at listening to like an anti-gay joke and seeing who laughs and who confronts it. Or listening to a sermon and seeing whether we're included. You know, there are a lot of ways that we can signal people that we are affirming of gay and lesbian people without coming out and asking someone. So I think the best thing to do is to simply educate yourself so that if he does come out or if someone else comes out, you know what he's going through or she's going through. Start thinking about the issues that oppress lesbians and gay men, and if they're important to you, start challenging them. Don't laugh the next time a fag joke is told. It's very hurtful to us. And the same way, it's no longer appropriate to laugh at nigger jokes. At one time it was, everybody used to laugh at them. Unfortunately, people still laugh at fag jokes, and until we all start challenging the kind of discrimination that takes place in our society, people won't feel free to come out of the closet. But you'll be amazed I have friends who are heterosexual who they almost have an avalanche of people coming out to them because they have so restructured their lives to be open and affirming of gay people, and they do that just in their everyday lives. And so when lesbians or gay men feel like they need to talk with someone, they know that's a person they can trust. And so those are the main kinds of things I think you can do.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the therapy groups that try to deal with the gay people who wish to change? What do you feel about
it? The question is, am I familiar with the therapy groups that try to deal with gay people who wish to change or feel they need to change their sexual orientation? Yes, I'm familiar with them primarily by lesbian and gay friends who were in them at one point and tried to change their orientation. I certainly don't want to slander the experience of anybody for whom that has been a positive change, but almost all of the studies by therapists and psychology and people who've been to those ministries or therapy groups point out that it's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to change one's orientation. There may be people who are, I didn't get into the Kinsey scale or any, the fact that our sexuality probably lies more on a spectrum rather than either you're homosexual or you're heterosexual. We probably all have somewhere on the spectrum between and have all aspects of sexuality in us. And there may be people who are bisexual who can, through those therapy groups, change their orientation or move it more to one side or the other. But I think the vast experience of people that I know and my own experience, all of us have tried for years to be heterosexual, and it just didn't work. And I think if you think about it, if you look at your own sexual orientation, regardless of what it is, think about trying to change it. If you're heterosexual, think about what it would take for you to become homosexual. With a lot of prayer, a lot of support, people telling you that you'll be put in prison if you don't. I mean, there's all sorts of different motivations to do it. But I think you begin to realize it's impossible. Who we are as sexual people is so intimately intertwined as to who we are. And so I am familiar with those groups. I think that they have caused a tremendous amount of hurt and disappointment and frustration for many people. Because there are a lot of people who are gay who, because of the experience of rejection they felt, don't want to be gay. And I think that offers false hope that's not there. And I don't think it's, I'll leave it at that.
It's cruel.
I think it is cruel. I think it is anti-gospel. I think it's asking of people what God does not ask of people. And there is a book that I would recommend for all of you if you're interested. There's a short book called Is the Homosexual My Neighbor? By Leticia Gansoni and Virginia Raimi Mullenkot. That Tommy has a wonderful chapter on lots of different things, but it has a section on those, what they call the ex-gay ministries, or the quote ministries that try and turn people into heterosexuals, and they cite the studies that show what a very, very high failure rate that has had, and the very negative. I've known people who it has really ruined their lives for years afterwards, the kind of torture they put themselves through to try and change, and I don't believe it's necessary. I think the bells mean it's time for Vespers. Just close by saying I hope that this will be, that all of you will feel free to talk to me during this week. That we'll have lots of chances during the other sessions to deal with some of the other issues like the Bible and homophobia. And I hope that this will start a lot of good conversations. So thank you very much for coming tonight.